worth 25 quid. She dragged it from the bedroom to the corridor and over to the tree-down. There she mounted it and hoisted herself high. She felt round the top of the tree-down in the dust and the grime, along the edges and into the centre, till she found the key. Her bowels were loosening as she got down from the stool and approached the door with the key in her hand. She had to do it, for she understood now that whatever was behind the door was something terrible, and she had to know exactly what it was, because it seemed to her that it was the only thing left that was capable of explaining to her why she was the way she was, and why she would continue to be that way if she didn't open that door and step into the room behind it. The key was a burning brand in her palm. Hastily, then, she stuck it into the keyhole and turned it to release the lock. Her heart was thudding, so she took a moment, and she shut her eyes tight, not to blind her vision, but to force the tears to go somewhere besides down her cheeks. This was stupid, she told herself. It was just a room. What was she expecting to find inside? Dancing skeletons? Jack the Ripper? Poltergeists tossing the furniture round? She made herself do it. She swung the door open, and although her limbs were shaking so badly, she wasn't sure she could even move forward. She managed it. Eyes open, arms at her side, feet rising and falling on a scarred wooden floor, and then upon an old Persian carpet. Ding saw it was a bedroom like any other, save for the fact that it was musty with lack of use, with lack of fresh air, with lack of dusting and hoovering. It was dark inside because the heavy curtains were closed, but still she could see the shapes of furniture. Her breath began to come faster, though, as she took it all in. A chest of drawers, a heavy chair, an armoire, a bed with four posters, a dressing table, and suddenly she knew she hadn't been meant to go inside this room then, either. But she did go inside, and why was it? Why, except now? Yes, she remembered it was the dog, but had there ever been a dog? Yes, there had been, and was he inside the room? No, he hadn't been, had he, but he was upstairs where he wasn't allowed, and he was in the drop-down position her dad had taught him, and when she went to him and tried to take him away, because no one was supposed to bother her father when he was in that room, the dog bared his teeth, which he never ever did, because he knew he wasn't supposed to show his teeth. Then he whined some more, and that was why she opened the door, because she knew the dog wanted, no, he needed to go inside that room, just the way she had done. But what was it? What was it about this room? Ding! My God! I thought I heard something! Ding swung round. There stood her mother in the doorway, with fingers on her lips and an expression on her face that told Ding something was there. There, just at the edge of her own consciousness. Her mother extended her hand and said, "You gave me such a fright! What are you doing here? Come out of there!" Yes. It was the gesture. It was the words combined with the gesture. What are you doing here? Come out of there. And Ding remembered. All of it. She said, "It wasn't an accident." "You told me it was. You said he was working in the house and there was something he was doing with electricity because of the flex. It was a flex, and you thought I would believe..." It suddenly felt as if something deadly was flowing from her along with her words, a foul effluent that would drown them both. "You lied to me!" she cried. "You lied to me! You lied to me, and you kept lying! Ding, come out of there now, please!" And then behind her mother in the doorway, Ding saw her stepfather. And in a flash it was so much worse, because she remembered him, her father's old school friend, her father's best friend, and he was there as well, just after it happened. No, he was there when it happened, and why was he there? What was he doing there? Why had he come? "You killed him!" she cried. "I remember! He was..." She looked round the room and found it. She found it. She pointed to one of the two posters at the end of the bed. It was thick and carved and constructed of that same heavy and unbreakable oak that so much of the house had been made from, and that was where he had hanged himself. "The flex! That flex! It was round his neck, and he was... Mum, he was naked, and he was dead!" Her mother entered the room then. She said over her shoulder to her husband, "Stephen, let me handle this. Let me..." "Lie!" Ding wept. "Stephen, let me lie, is what you mean. Stephen, let me lie. Let me tell her something so she won't ever know what I did, what we did, because both of you did it. Both of you planned it. You wanted to be together, didn't you? So stop it. Stephen, for God's sake, leave us."
"She needs to know what happened," Ding's stepfather said.
"Yes, all right, I realize that. Now go, Ding, come out of this room."
Oh, she would. She would. She would come out.
And then she did so, brushing past her mother and her stepfather, hurtling down the corridor in the direction of the wide stairway that would take her to the main entrance hall below, and then to the door, and finally she was out in the air, because she had to get away, only she could hear her mother calling for her to stop, just stop, but she would not listen, she would not. And there was the church and its graveyard, but the road, was in the opposite direction, and she had to get to the road at once, because there she could find the bus that would take her to...
"He killed himself, Dina! He didn't mean to! It was an accident, but he killed himself!"
She spun round.
"You're lying, because that's what you do. You always lie. You lie and lie, and you always have, and I hate you!"
But she was finished running, and she knew it. She sank onto the uncut grass next to a grave marker, so old and worn that nothing remained upon it save the indication by its presence that someone long forgotten lay buried beneath it. When her mother reached her, she did not protest. When her mother dropped onto the grass next to her, she did not try to get away. Her mother did not speak at first. She seemed to be waiting. Ding reckoned she was waiting for courage. Or perhaps she was waiting only for calm. After a bit, she said,
"Ding, you were 4 years old, and just barely that. I couldn't tell you, because there was no way to explain to a 4-year-old what her father had been doing in that room, and that what he'd been doing had caused his death. How could you ever have understood that he used that room for... that when he wanted... it was autoeroticism. That's how he died. Do you know what that is? Well, you must, because children know things these days that they would never have known before this bloody age of information. I didn't know what he was doing in there. All I knew was that we weren't meant to go into that room when the door was closed, because he said he'd be reading, and he wanted to be able to read in peace for an hour or so. That was all he said. Just a bit of time to relax. Earlier, this was before you were even born, I'd caught him at it, but not there in that room, because it was before I inherited the house. He'd told me he'd read about it in one of his novels, and he'd been curious, and it was only that one time, and he could see how dangerous it was. He swore he would never do it again. He was lying, of course, because that's what people do. You were right in that, Dina. People lie. And I lied to you because I didn't know how to explain to a 4-year-old girl who'd just come upon her dead, naked, strung-up father that he'd done this to himself because he wanted... he just had to have... it was all about him and his pleasure, and he didn't think about us. So there he was, in the middle of a Saturday afternoon, naked with a flex round his neck, hanging from a bedpost, with his face contorted and his eyes, and yes, you are absolutely right, I did not tell you, because the last thing I ever wanted was that you would remember how he died, much less why he died like that.
Ding's hand had risen to cover her mouth. Her mother had long since begun to weep. She herself saw the past in a series of images, pushed so far back into her memory that she wondered if they were real at all. The uniforms of the police. Someone carrying, what, a medical bag? Figures passing along the corridor. The black garb of a priest. An ambulance trolley rolling along the corridor. The long, dark, zippered bag. The dog barking at all the intruders and all the confusion. Her mother weeping, questions being asked and answers being given, and a woman coming into her room and sitting on the edge of the bed. And she had been the paediatrician, hadn't she? And she was saying over her shoulder, "Children this young." And to Ding herself, "Let's see if we can help you sleep a little, sweetheart." Because it had been a nightmare, hadn't it, that she'd awakened from, terrified, and if she went to sleep when she next awoke, it would all be as if it had never happened. She understood. Not why her father had done that to himself. Not why her mother had lied to her for years upon years, but why she herself had taken the route she'd taken, the one that was gaining her nothing, and would continue to do so should she remain upon it. Colebrookdale, Shropshire. Timothy was still at work in the pharmacy when Yasmina returned to the clinic late that afternoon. She found him counting out a prescription for antibiotics for an elderly gentleman sent from Broseley's chemist, who'd apparently run out of the drug. Once the pills were ready, Timothy did what he'd always done, carefully explain how they were meant to be taken. When he'd made certain the old gent understood, he clasped the man's shoulder and said, "You're going to mind me, aren't you?" To which the reply was a gruff, "Got a feeling you'll chase me down if I don't." Timothy promised that he would do just that, squeezed the man's shoulder and sent him on his way, which was out to a minivan where someone who looked like his daughter was waiting. Then Timothy turned to Yasmina. "Did you play the truant today?" His tone was friendly, and he was smiling the same smile that had at first beguiled her all those years ago. "Where'd you get off to?
The cinema? A shopping trip? I went to Ludlow.
The smile disappeared. Caution came onto his features.
Everything fine with Mum?
I went to the college, she told him.
It took a moment before he said, Yes, Nina, in a tone that established its position on the border between warning and resignation. He went to lock the front doors to the pharmacy. He returned and began to deal with the till, opening its drawer and removing from it the tray that contained notes and coins. He set this to one side and looked at her.
You must know that approach isn't going to work. How can you say that when you have no idea why I went there?
He removed the notes from the tray, and from beneath the counter he brought out the leather zip pouch in which he deposited the money at night. He put the notes inside it, and then added the coins, saying,
I'm not a fool. If you enter the college, it has to do with me, sir.
You're right, of course.
She smoothed her hand along the counter. It wanted a good dusting, and she wondered if she would have to speak to the cleaners about it, or, more probably, do the work herself, as she'd already spoken to them twice about the cavalier attitude they had towards doing anything more than casually mopping the floor.
Yes, Mina, you must be able to see by now that what you're doing is going to drive her away. It's basic human psychology. What I'm doing is trying to keep her from ending up as someone she never intended to be in the first place and will hate becoming.
Timothy sighed. The money taken care of, he went to the drugs next. From the cabinet shelves, he moved the opiates into the plastic baskets in which they were stored for depositing, along with the money, in the pharmacy's safe. He said,
That's just the problem. You act like someone who can see the future when you can barely understand the present. What I understand is my purpose as her mum, which is to help her set a course for her life. If you won't recognize that as your purpose as her father, you put me into the position of having to do the entire job alone.
He let the implied accusation sit there. Yasmina thought his silence meant that he was thinking over what she'd said. But then he replied with,
It's not my purpose, or any part of my purpose, to insist Missa do what she clearly doesn't want to do. You seem to have forgotten that she wanted college. She wanted university. She had plans for her life, and now she has none. Doesn't that seem strange to you?
It doesn't, because I don't agree with that picture of things in the first place. He went into the back, where the safe was. The sounds from the interior indicated he was securing the money and the opiates. In a moment he returned. He'd removed his lab coat, she saw, and now he stood before her. He was closer to her then than he'd been in months, save when he was sleeping. And she saw how drawn he looked, how the last years had aged him. Lines incised a path from his nose to the corners of his mouth, and from there they etched downward to his chin. His hair was fast becoming more salt than pepper, and his eyes were no longer bright and engaged. They seemed to beg for the moment when he would take something pinched from the pharmacy to ease his way into oblivion. He couldn't possibly want to engage with her just now. But he did so.
"Missa has plans," he said. "They may have changed from what they were originally, but you know what they are. You just don't want to accept them. No one changes to this degree. It doesn't happen, not without a cause."
But she has changed, and there's a logic to it. She tried college, and she found it to be not what she wanted. She decided she needed to take another route, which she told us last December. She wanted out, and she wanted to be home, but you couldn't accept that.
It wasn't a matter of accepting. It was a matter of clarifying. At her age,
I don't understand why you're telling yourself such rubbish, Timothy cut in, or why you're rewriting your history with Missa.
The facts remain the facts. You insisted she return to Ludlow after the Christmas holiday in order to give it another go. She's always been a cooperative girl, and you and I might look at that at some point. So she did as you told her. But if you want the truth from where I'm standing now and where I was standing then, you browbeat her into cooperating, Yasmina.
Yasmina felt the insult as a suffusion of heat.
This is how you remember things? It's how things were.
Really?
Has your brain become so addled because of what you're ingesting every night that you can't recall any basic facts about what's happening inside your own family?
Don't go there, Yasmina. She saw the tension in the muscles of his arms where they crossed against his chest. She said,
No, it's time we spoke of this. Night after night you've been drugging yourself with what you've stolen from this pharmacy. You can't see what's in front of your face begging to be seen because when you're not drugged you end up with memories of Jana and you can't...
Yes, I'm telling you...
His right hand made a gesture, telling her to stop.
Allow yourself to live through what the rest of us are living through, because it's hell, yes. That's what it is, and that's what it was. And look at me, Timothy, the doctor, the bloody paediatrician, for the love of God, who didn't see it, who didn't catch it, who didn't know what to think when her own child wasn't well, because to think and to recognize and to know what it meant. God, I would love to drug myself. Day and night I would, but then what happens? What's happened already? There's your answer. Your eldest daughter is falling apart while you declare she must be who she would like to be. Whatever that means. Because that absolves you of responsibility, doesn't it? That allows you to drug yourself.
I'm not listening to this. He walked to the switch for the overhead lights. She followed him.
I'm beyond caring what you do, but I will not give up on Nyssa.
He swung back to her.
Which means what exactly?
She said, Greta Yates is the counsellor at West Mercia College. She's asked to have an opportunity to have a conversation with Nyssa so that she can understand what's gone wrong. She's also said it's a simple enough thing for her to catch up with the work since she left, but they need to get to the bottom of why she left in the first place so they can help her.
His gaze fixed on her.
Do you ever listen to what I tell you? My first thought was that if you and I spoke to Nyssa together and presented...
She was finding it difficult to speak. She paused, told herself that she could do this, and then went on...
If you and I presented a united front, merely on the subject of Nyssa having a conversation with the college counsellor, she would do it.
Yasmina, I'm having no part in this.
Yes, indeed, she would do it, especially if she knows it's merely a conversation with no expectations.
Stop it, Yas.
And I believe that Justin would be willing to make sure she got to Ludlow to keep an appointment there, especially if we approach it correctly. So I intend to speak to him as well. I've already had an initial word. I'm to meet with him, and I thought if you went with me...
The world isn't malleable, he said. I'm not going to be part of your attempt to mould it.
Which I take to mean you've no interest in learning anything about what constitutes the why of life.
He barked a short, unpleasant laugh. Whatever you say, Yasmina. So she was left to alter the plan and do the rest on her own. Upon ringing Justin earlier from Ludlow, she'd been surprised when he explained that their meeting would have to take place on the site of the Jackfield Tile Museum. This stood in the hamlet of Jackfield itself, on the opposite side of the River Severn from Ironbridge, just southeast of the town's eponymous bridge. The Tile Museum was a complex of buildings tucked to the east of an enclave of houses, on the upper part of a wooded acclivity that had long protected it from the periodic flooding of the river's banks. Some tiles were still made here, hand-painted here and fired here, memorialising the heyday of Victorian and Edwardian decorative arts. The museum itself contained thousands of other tiles, the real thing, from those that together might form a scene of domestic life to those that stood alone to add beauty to a fireplace, a floor, a porch, or a piece of furniture. But there were more buildings than there was present-day use for when it came to making tiles, and some of them were let out for other purposes. Yasmina discovered that Justin Goodale had taken one of these buildings, and he was waiting for her in front of it at their appointed meeting time. A young woman was with him, her paint-splodged pinafore apron indicating that she was part of the tile-making that still went on in the location. She was chatting Justin up with a fair amount of industry, from what Yasmina could see. Her flirting should have been obvious to Justin, but he seemed immune to her smile, her light touch on his arm, and the way she played with tendrils of her autumn-hued hair that escaped from the kerchief that held it away from her face. Justin waved happily as he saw Yasmina, and when she parked her car and joined him and his companion, he introduced the girl as Heather Hawkes. She dimpled and said she had to be off.
She added, "Think about it, Jess. Miss is invited as well."
"I'll speak with her," was his reply. "She's not much for crowd scenes, though."
"Come on your own, then."
"Perhaps. We'll see."
This seemed to please her.
As she twirled and headed in the direction of the Tile Works paint shop, Yasmina said to Justin,
"She'll depend upon it, that one."
He smiled sweetly, that honest Justin smile of his that told Yasmina he wasn't sure what she meant. So she said,
"She'd be quite happy to have you to herself, that girl."
"Oh, I don't think so, Dr. Lomax. Me and Missa, we went to school with Heather's sister. I've known Heather since she was in Nappies. Come with me. I've got something to show you before you and me talk."
He walked to the huge double doors of the brick building in front of which he'd been standing with Heather. As he did so, he dug in the pocket of his jeans and pulled out a set of keys. One of them fitted the shiny chub lock on the double doors. He swung them wide so Yasmina could see what was inside. It was a surprising setup, illuminated by a skylight high in the ceiling and by banks of fluorescent tubes that Justin switched on. One of these hung above a scarred workbench that sat along one of the walls. An array of tools were neatly arranged above it, and along the back of it large tins were labelled for various kinds of nails and screws. A rank of rolled papers sat at one end of this table, some of them tightly bound with elastic bands and others loosely formed into tubes. At the far end of the area stood several kinds of electric saws, and to one side a stand on wheels where various sorts of hand tools hung. On the opposite wall from the workbench, shelves held tins of paint and brushes and rollers, with more fluorescent lights above them. The scent in the air mixed sawdust and fresh paint, and it seemed to relate to what was in the centre of a very large working area. This was a wooden structure fashioned not unlike an extremely high-end garden shed. Painted blue with pristinely white trim, it featured French windows in the front of it as a means of gaining entry. Over them hung a miniature trellis, suitable, Yasmina reckoned, for wisteria, grapes, or climbing roses. "What do you think?" Justin's eagerness made him seem even younger than he was.
"It's extraordinary."
Yasmina approached it, wondering who on earth would ever want such a fanciful structure for stowing a lawnmower and bags of potting soil.
"Here, let me show you the rest."
He passed her and swung the French windows open.
"This is my demonstration model. It's meant for show. See for yourself."
She saw that the structure contained a neatly made full-size bed, along with a small table and two chairs. Above the table on the wall was a hanging rack for plates and cups, and on the table an electric kettle stood. From the ceiling hung a brass chandelier. From the wall on either side of the bed, brass angle-poised lights for reading had been fitted. It was beautifully done, Yasmina thought. She had no idea what it was for, however. She said,
"It's lovely.
What's it called? I mean, does it have a name? You mean like Shady Bower or summer?"
She smiled.
"I mean like garden shed."
"Oh, this one's meant to be for glamping, but there've other uses as well."
"Glamping?"
She walked through the French windows and stood at the foot of the bed. The headboard was fashioned from wrought iron and painted the same white as the exterior trim, while the interior of the place was painted a soothing shade of yellow, and the counterpane on the bed was speckled with flowers of the same hue. She turned to him.
"This is extraordinary, Justin. I'd no idea—"
She didn't add what she'd been thinking. She'd had no idea he was so good at something. But then, why wouldn't he be?
"Most people don't know about it."
It seemed he'd let her "no idea" refer to glamping.
"It's a step above camping, or perhaps three steps above. See, camping means that someone shows up at a site, say a farmer's paddock in the Lake District, either dragging a caravan behind the car or getting ready to set up a tent. It rains or it blows and the tent gets knocked about. But one of these is steady and sturdy, and it's already there when the campers arrive. It's called a pod. It's generally on wheels, so town councils and English Heritage and whatever can't say the farmer's put a permanent structure where one's not allowed." She said,
"You mean he can move it here or there, in the paddock or wherever?"
Justin nodded. He went on to enthuse about how a pod could be fitted with electricity and even be plumbed if it was allowed to stay in one place. Each was big enough to accommodate two adults, and should fold-out cots be added to the pod, two children as well.
"They could be used for everything, the pods," he continued. "I've done one for a lady who's made it her painting studio, and another's being used as a miniature tea-house in a good-sized garden. They do a fine job as beach huts as well. Of course, they're a little high-end for that, but you can see what I mean. And they can be used as shelters if the weather gets rough. A gent outside of Shrewsbury wanted one to make his fishing ties in and to stow his gear, and I built that one half-timbered. Here, let me show you."
She followed him to the workbench upon which the rolls of paper lay. He took one of the loose ones, unrolled it, and weighed it down with the tins that held the nails and screws. She saw that this was a detailed drawing of one of his little buildings, only this one looked like a miniature barn, and it was accessed by a Dutch door that in the drawing hung half open.
"I had no idea your talents stretched to this," Yasmina said. "I mean, of course, I know about how well you do with blacksmithing, but working with wood like this, I'm very impressed."
He ducked his head in pleasure.
"I won't ever set the world on fire with my brain, but I've got ideas that my hands can bring off easy as anything. Mum's always said that following one's talent is the ticket, so that's really all I've done. The others, I mean my brothers and sisters, they're the clever ones. Just is our dumb one, Dad would say. But Mum said once I worked out what I was meant to do, she'd see I had the means to do it."
"How long have you been at this?"
"Near 3 years. I'm working on saving for me and Missa, once I get enough money together."
He looked suddenly bashful.
"You know."
Yasmina was grateful that he'd given her an entree into the talk she needed to have with him. She said,
Missa can also contribute to the life you have together, Justin.
Course, he agreed, and she will, because we both want a family, and we mean to start at that straight off. Not an over-the-top family, mind you, but perhaps three little ones. Three's a good number. We've talked about it, her and me. Mostly the when of it, mind. When's a good time for both of us is what we've asked each other. Now Missa's settled back into Bliss Hill, and now I've got this business here off the ground, and I've got my blacksmithing as well. Any time is a good time, is the way I see it. Mum agrees. She says, have your babies while you're young enough to chase them round. And then, when they're grown and on their own, you'll still have the rest of your life in front of you to do what you want with. Missa thinks Mum is right.
He spoke with such openness that Yasmina had a moment in which she reconsidered. Not the end, for really there could be only one, but instead the means. Justin was a very nice boy. Indeed, he was a very decent young man. He worshipped Missa. But a marriage between them was both unthinkable and unwise. She knew, however, that she couldn't tell him that, for that would be to court his refusal to help her, Yasmina, in what she needed him to do. She said, with an attempt at seeming to think things over,
I do see your point. It's a very good one.
Justin beamed at this, so she hastened to add,
But another point to consider is making certain both of you have careers, so that should something happen to either of you, you'll have a source of income to fall back upon.
He beamed a little less.
Like what? I'm not sure what you mean, is what I'm saying. You have your blacksmithing, and now this business you're starting, but Missa ought to have something as well.
Oh, I intend her to keep the books for me as we go along, and the business grows. She can do those while the little ones nap, and later on while they're in school. That way she'll be at home for them.
But if something happens to you, Missa won't be able to build the pods. And she's not a blacksmith. What she'll be is a mum and a housekeeper for you, and perhaps a candle maker at the Victorian town. But you must ask yourself if that's actually enough to support your children, you and herself, should you be in need of her becoming the main breadwinner.
He frowned, apparently sorting this out.
But why would she need to do that, Dr. Lomax? Long as I've got my hands. We never know what the future will bring. I mean, we don't know what might happen to us. A sudden illness, a physical condition that we weren't expecting, an accident. That's what I'm talking about.
Justin looked down at his hands. He was silent longer than Yasmina expected. She wondered if he was trying to sort through what she'd said in order to have some clarity, but he greatly surprised her with what he said next.
You want her to go back to the college, and then on to uni. There's a counsellor in Ludlow who wants to speak with her, Justin. I talked to her earlier today. She told me that her job is to get to the bottom of things when a student decides to leave the college. But Missa, this woman told me, bypassed that step altogether. She'd like to guide her through it, and if at the end she's satisfied that Missa has taken a decision in her own best interests, then that's that.
He looked up then. Not for the first time, she thought. What a shame it was that he was so slow. As if good looks and intelligence ought naturally to go together. He said,
You want me to talk her into speaking with this counsellor person, eh? I do, Justin. I want you to take her to see the counsellor as well. I want you to be in the meeting with them. I believe with all my heart that Missa is meant for more than keeping your books and having babies and making candles on the side. And Justin, my dear, I think you believe that as well.
Slowly he rolled the sketch back up into the loose tube it had formed. He placed it carefully where it had been along with some others. He said,
She won't want to go to Ludlow. I agree, she won't, but I believe you can talk to her about it, and she'll listen to you if you use the right approach.
What's that, then? He turned from the workbench and leaned against it, his hands thrust into the pockets of his jeans. Yasmina had already thought this through.
Tell her that I've come to you. Tell her that I've asked you to do this. Tell her that nothing is ever going to sway me from my belief in her future as a professional woman like myself.
How's that meant to get her on board?
Because you'll also tell her that the only way she'll be able to get me to let this subject die is for her to speak to Greta Yates, the counsellor at the college. You're to tell her that she's to insist, to me, I mean, that you're going to take her to Ludlow, and that she's to insist that you attend the meeting with her when she speaks with Miss Yates. You're to tell her that you agree with every decision she's made in her life, including her decision to leave West Mercia College. But after having me browbeat you for an hour, you've decided that the only way to get me away from both of you is to meet with the counsellor so that she, Missa, can tell her personally why she left the college and why she doesn't wish to return.
He drew his eyebrows together.
Yasmina was forced to wonder whether he would be capable of carrying this off. She reckoned he might need a crib to refer to. She told herself, however, that she had to have faith in him, since she was about to offer him the world. She said,
"And when you're in this meeting, Justin, I want you to be persuaded that Mrs. returning to the college in preparation for university is actually a very sensible plan. Indeed, it's what you want her to do, so that she'll always have a way to take care of herself and your children should anything happen to you. And once you've done this, and once she's agreed to return to the college, I want you to set a date."
"For what?"
"For your marriage, my dear," she said gently. "It can't happen at once, of course, but the moment she completes her education, the very week she receives her final degree, there'll be a wedding. A lovely one with all the trimmings, after which you may take her off on a honeymoon somewhere quite wonderful, and after that you may invest in a house suitable for raising the children you intend to have together."
He shook his head. He scuffed one of his boot-shod feet against the rough floor of the building. He said, "I'm saving my money. But all that, it's not something... not for a while, at least." She put her hand on his arm.
"You misunderstand, my dear. The house and honeymoon are our wedding gifts to you, her father's and mine."
His head lifted quickly, and his expression, she saw, was quite apprehensive as he said,
"Oh, I could never, Dr. Lomax. It wouldn't be right. I'm the man, and the man is expected—"
"And it would lower me in her eyes. I wouldn't ever want that." She squeezed his arm and smiled at him with great affection, because she did feel real affection for him. She said,
"I don't believe anything would ever lower you in Miss's eyes. But you and I don't need to work out every detail just now. What I want to know at the moment is, may I ring Greta Yates and make an appointment with her, for Miss and you and what we've discussed?"
"Missus not going to want to do this," he said reluctantly, but far less decisively than before.
"That remains to be seen. It will all depend on your approach. Will you think about doing this for me, and for her and for your future?"
He seemed to consider all this. He might, she thought, be working out in his head exactly what he was going to say to Missa. Finally he said to her,
"When, then?"
"Your conversation with Missa, going to Ludlow?"
"Both," he said.
"As soon as is ever possible."
Quality Square, Ludlow, Shropshire. There was always a chance that Dina Donaldson wasn't going to turn up at the Hart and Hind that evening. But barring waiting outside the house in Teamside with Harry Rochester in the hope that she would eventually present herself, the pub seemed to Barbara Havers the best option. As they approached Castle Square, Linley said, "If there's bad blood between Harry Rochester and the PCSO, this could be a futile activity, Barbara. You do know that."
"Do," she said. "But no matter which direction we head, I end up going back to the fact that right from the start, Gaz Ruddock either massaged the truth when he had no reason to, or he left out details that he knew were important. And the more we've looked at the bloke, the more he's left out details we've eventually come up with. Some woman he's involved with, some girl he's bonking, a college boy he's meant to watch over, Finnegan Freeman, his mum, his dad, his housemate. Way I see it, we need something to lay before this bloke that's going to cause him to start talking frankly. I'm willing to try anything to get us there, including involving Ludlow's number one dosser in the project."
Harry Rochester had not yet arrived when they reached the Hart and Hind, dodging a boisterous frisbee event in Quality Square itself. As the evening was pleasant, a fair number of drinkers were outside on the terrace in front of the place. There was plenty going on, but the serious action appeared to be at a table where a curious form of chess was being played. Two teams were battling, young men against young women, with 15 seconds allowed between changing players and making moves as well. The match seemed to include a form of stripping off one's kit. If a chess piece was taken, the player who caused its loss had to remove an article of clothing. 5 players to the team, and the girls were beating the trousers off the boys, literally. Barbara ducked inside the pub. There weren't as many drinkers inside as out, so it took less than 20 seconds for her to see they'd won a packet with her plan. Dina Donaldson was tossing back something in a pint glass along with one of her mates. Perfect. All that was required was sending Harry Rochester inside for a quick recce. If he recognised Dina as a girl he'd seen with Gaz Ruddock, they were in the clover, one step closer to getting to the truth of what had gone on the night Druitt died. Unfortunately, she did not take into account Harry's advanced claustrophobia. What were 30 seconds inside a pub? More than he could handle as things developed. When she returned to Linley, it was to see that Harry had arrived, Sweet Pea at his side. He'd brought along his gear for dossing as well, and he explained that since they'd required his presence in the centre of town this late in the evening, he'd fetched his clobber from the other side of the river, and would use Ludlow's outdoor accommodations, as he fashioned the term, somewhere in the immediate vicinity.
"Let's go inside," Barbara told both Linley and Harry simultaneously. "This will take less than a minute. Have a look round, and if you see any girl who's been with Ruddock, just memorise what she's wearing, and—"
"Inside?"
Harry's entire throat jumped with a gulp he took.
"I couldn't possibly—"
"We'll be just out here. Or if you want, I can go inside with you and hang on to your hand."
"No, no," Harry said. "You don't understand. I simply can't."
"You go in the bank to have a word with your banker, right? This can't be much different from that."
"He comes out."
"He—"
"What?" "He comes out. I ring him with my mobile, and he comes out onto the pavement. I haven't actually been inside a building. Well, it's been years. Aside from the spa, and as I said earlier, they know what I want, so they have it ready for me at the till."
"What about if you get sick? Don't you go to the doctor's surgery?"
"I'm blessed with remarkable health,
but we need you to—"
Here Linley intervened.
"We'll wait for girls to come out."
He looked at his pocket watch. Harry, Barbara noted, appeared damned impressed that Linley actually sported a pocket watch, another of his anachronistic quirks. "The pub closes soon enough," Linley added.
"This can't take any more than an hour."
Harry looked relieved. They found places somewhat out of the main area of the terrace so that when Dina Donaldson emerged, they would be able to see her without her noticing them. In the meantime, they watched the progression of the chess game. The boys, Barbara thought, had obviously come to the event unprepared. They wore far too few items of clothing. Two of them were down to their smalls, while none of the girls were showing any flesh at all. Barbara wondered what happened at checkmate. She wasn't sure she wanted to be a witness. It looked as if that wasn't going to be a worry, because as she shifted her gaze from chess to the pub's door, Dina Donaldson emerged. Barbara shot Linley a look. Dina was alone, so there shouldn't be the slightest problem that Harry would not see her, or would confuse her with a companion. She waited. Dina walked into the light shed by one of the overhanging bulbs that crisscrossed the terrace. Someone called her name and she swung round, which placed her fully into view. She was joined by yet another girl. They set off together in the direction of Quality Square, earnestly in conversation.
"Ah," Harry said. "Yes, I've seen that one."
"Perfect," Barbara thought. On Harry's other side, though, Linley said—
"Which one?"
"The blonde."
"They're both blonde, Harry," Barbara noted.
"Oh, sorry, of course. The taller one," he said.
"But—"
"Are you certain?" Linley asked the man.
"As much as I can be, given that it was night when I saw them."
Barbara wanted to shake the bloke. This wasn't the result she wanted. This wasn't the result she'd expected. This wasn't the bloody result they needed. Not with Harry Rochester overlooking Dina Donaldson in favour of someone else.
"The other girl?"
she said.
"It was worth a try." "The other blonde, the shorter one? What about her? You got a good look at her face, didn't you?"
"I did indeed. I've seen her about. That's not much, though, is it? I've seen most people about.
But not with Gary Ruddock."
He shook his head.
"With some boys from the college and with other girls, but not with Ruddock, as I recall."
He looked sorrowfully at her.
"Was she the one you were hoping I'd point out to you? I'm terribly sorry. I do want to help."
"You have." Linley's tone was a model of reassurance, although Barbara wanted to strangle the dosser. Linley said with meaning, "Sergeant, shall we be on our way? Shall we leave Mr. Rochester to find his spot for the night?" She knew what Linley's objective was. They needed to follow the taller girl, and they needed to do it now. Ludlow, Shropshire. Linley's intention to follow the girl proved to be entirely unnecessary. Whatever she and Dina Donaldson had needed to discuss had evidently been discussed, for less than a minute after she'd disappeared round the corner into Quality Square proper with Dina, the other girl returned and went back inside the pub. Seeing her, Harry Rochester said,
"Shall I stay, then?"
although he didn't sound happy with the prospect. Linley said it wasn't necessary, but what was necessary, he said, would be for Sergeant Havers to wait outside for him. He could tell she wasn't pleased with this, but she would know the reason. The publican understood that she was a cop. He didn't know that about Linley. Once inside, Linley saw that the girl was at the bar. She appeared to be trying to get a free drink out of the publican. He waited for her to buy or beg whatever she intended to imbibe. He waited for her to carry it to a table. Neither happened. He approached the bar. "May I have a word?" he said to the girl, and he added, "What are you drinking?" as lubrication. She turned halfway and seemed to size him up. "Aren't you gorgeous?" she said. "I was drinking lager, but I'd actually prefer gin and tonic." Linley nodded to the publican, who managed a blustering guffaw, as if he'd seen this kind of operation on the girl's part before, as he probably had. "Aren't you drinking as well?" the girl said to Linley. She lowered her gaze briefly, either to take in his trousers or to show off her eyelashes, which were quite long and seemed to be real. But who really knew? "I don't much like drinking alone. Oh, Francie, what's your name?"
"Thomas Linley," he said, and in a lower voice, "New Scotland Yard. I need a word with you."
She looked up. Her blue eyes widened, but it seemed more mockery than surprise. She said,
"I don't think I've broken any laws recently, but if I have, can I depend that you'll be the arresting officer?"
She held out her wrists and added coyly, "Or can I do something else for you?" And then to the publican, "Jack, do you think I'll look good in handcuffs? This Scotland Yard gentleman wants to take me away. Are you jealous?"
Jack put his gaze squarely on Linley and said, "Again with you lot. First we have Scotland Yard round one, and now we have Scotland Yard round two. You with that woman studying up on the Plantagenets, are you?"
"Do you already have a partner for tonight, then?" Francie asked Linley. "What a shame." She had her gin, two ice cubes, a slice of lime, and a small can of tonic. She opened this last, poured in a dollop, took a drink, and said with a smile,
"Let's call it ready, officer."
Glass in hand, she sauntered towards the door. She waited for Linley to follow, which he did. Then outside, Barbara Havers joined them. Francie looked her over, looked back at Linley, offered a half-smile that was probably meant to be knowing, and said,
"Now where shall we chat?"
Linley didn't want a chance being seen by Gary Ruddock should the PCSO stop by the pub, and he cast a look at Havers. She said,
"St. Lawrence is not far, sir. It has that churchyard."
Linley nodded at her, and she led the way. Francie said,
"You plan to question me in a graveyard? What sort of police work happens in a graveyard?"
"Digging up corpses, generally," Havers said over her shoulder. "But I reckon we'll let that one go tonight, as there aren't any graves. Anyway, we'd like to have a word and not be seen having a word. We can do it somewhere else. Live at home, do you? On your own? With a flatmate? What?"
"The graveyard's fine,"
Francie said shortly, which was answer enough as to where she lived. The girl's parents would ask questions that she probably didn't want asked, should she show up at home with two detectives from New Scotland Yard. The churchyard wasn't dark, but it was private. One of the larger yews provided deep shadows, but otherwise the location was lit by street lamps along two of its sides. Havers made for the tree, and Francie tripped along in her wake. Linley brought up the rear.
"All right."
Francie took a position that offered her the most darkness, and also the tree trunk to lean against, in a position that thrust her chest outwards.
"What do you want?"
What they wanted first was to understand the nature of her relationship with Dina Donaldson.
"Is she in trouble?"
The girl sounded far more interested than worried. She took a sip of her drink and watched Linley over the rim of the glass. Havers she ignored.
"Interesting that you would make that leap," Linley said to her.
"What other leap am I supposed to make when the police want me to talk about someone? You're checking her out for some reason, and it can't be that she's applied for a job with you lot."
"Perceptive," Linley said.
Havers added,
"We've had a word with her. We'd like to confirm what she had to say."
"We just now saw you with her,"
Linley added. "You appear to be acquainted, so you seemed a good place to start."
"What do you mean, confirm what she had to say?"
Francie took a moment to mull this over when they didn't reply. She shifted her weight, putting her hand on her hip.
"Hey, is she making up some randomly weird story about me? Because if she is, let me tell you, everything started with her catching me blowing Brutus. Before that, we were super good friends, her and me. When she caught us, I explained to her that no way would I have been with Brutus if I'd known she was even minorly serious about him. And why would I have ever thought that anyway, because the entire world knows how much he sleeps around. And she is part of the world last time I looked, so it didn't mean anything that I was in his room and... Look, like I said, I explained it all to her. I keep explaining how it all happened that I ended up with him, which will not ever be repeated, which I also told her till I was blue in the face. So if she's trying to get me into trouble, which I wouldn't put past her because she's so, I don't know, it's like she's twitchy about everything these days."
"Sounds all tangled up,"
Havers noted. "If I'm following, what's going on involves you, Brutus, Dina, and various body parts, yes?
A bit of looking for love in all the wrong places, as the song goes.
Linley said, "Well, all of this is a fascinating study in human relationships. Whatever has gone on among the three of you, Dina, Brutus and you, isn't what we wish to speak to you about. We're far more interested in what's gone on between you and the PCSO here in town. Dina has made a claim that..."
"What? I'm blowing him as well? She's trying to get me into trouble, isn't she? Because of Brutus, or because of that stupid Brutus, or is it Ruddock she's trying to get into trouble? Ha! Let me tell you, carloads of people will be thrilled to bits about that."
"Why would that be?" Linley asked. Francie took another sip of her drink. Her eyes narrowed as she speculated.
"You two ask round if you want an answer to that. I'm not about to be your Ludlow snout. I have enough troubles already. Meantime, you should look into Ding's relationship with Gaz Ruddock, instead of trotting me out here in the middle of the night for a little chat."
"In a bloody graveyard, no less,"
Haver said.
"Trouble is, you've been identified."
"As what?"
"As a woman who's been seen with a PCSO. Inside his car.
Who supposedly saw me, then? And when?"
"Never mind, don't even bother to tell me, because whoever said that is bloody well lying.
According to our observer, you were in his patrol car being carted somewhere. What would that be about?"
"You mean someone's actually saying I was arrested? I've never even broken a law. You can check on your computers, or iPhones, or wherever you lot keep your information. Francis Adamucci, ADAMUCCI, middle name Sophia."
"No one's suggesting you were arrested," Linley pointed out. Havers added, "What you were up to indicates that arrest was the last thing on anyone's mind. Yours, the PCSO's, your guardian angel, the Archbishop of Canterbury." "What we've come to understand," Linley added, "is that the PCSO has been quite good about handling complaints that deal with the binge drinking that goes on in town. We've also learned that he's loaded drinkers into his vehicle and taken them away. And a final thing we know is that he has a relationship with someone that he wants to keep quiet, especially in light of the death that took place in the local police station. Now, which of those categories of relationships with the PCSO is the one you fall into?"
"Now you're saying that I killed someone?" "That wasn't one of the categories," Havers pointed out.
Francie stamped her foot. She was, Linley noted, careful not to spill any of her drink.
"I don't have to place myself in any category, and I'm not going to."
"Ultimately, you may want to," Linley said, "if only to keep yourself clear of suspicion."
"Suspicion of what?"
"Accessory to murder."
"What the hell? What's going on? I didn't do anything, and I've never done anything. Ding's gone totally round the bend if she's—"
"This isn't about Ding," Linley told her. "She's told us nothing about you and the PCSO."
"Then who said it? You tell me who."
"We can't give you the name," Linley said, "but we can tell you that you were identified this very night as having been seen with the PCSO inside his patrol car. We can also tell you that we didn't at all expect you to be the person identified."
"I have never, ever been in that patrol car, except when he's carted us home because we were drunk in Quality Square."
"Who is us, then?" Havers asked.
"Me and Chelsea, and we've always been together when it happened, and that is it. So whoever told you anything else is lying, or has rotten eyesight, or wants to get me stitched up for something."
"Why would that be?"
"Probably because I gave whoever it was his boyfriend a blowjob, which is what happened with Ding, all right? So if she's behind this..." "I already said, I didn't even know he was her boyfriend. I just knew they did it occasionally. But so does everyone else. There's no strings attached, and everyone knows it's just for a laugh. And if Ding's not behind this, then you lot better look at whoever it is told you the tale in the first place, because I'm telling you right now, that person's winding you up, and there's probably a real interesting reason why, which is what you ought to be concentrating on instead of taking me into bloody graveyards. You ask anyone over in the Hart and Hind if I ever been alone with Ruddock. You ask anyone drinking outside. You ask anyone in Castle Square. You ask anyone anywhere on the planet. Meantime, why aren't you lot doing something about Ruddock instead of harassing me?"
"You'll need to be more direct," Linley said. "Is there something about the PCSO that we need to know?"
"You want an answer to that? You talk to someone else, like Ding, or you talk to him, but no way do you keep talking to me."
Having said this, she brushed past them both and headed back the way they'd come. Havers said to Linley,
"On the vehemence scale, that bird's climbing the charts."
"I don't know whether to believe her or not."
"I don't know whether to believe anyone. But seems to me we're on to Harry Rochester next. We either got to have his eyesight tested, or we got to find out what's going on with him."
"Christ." Linley blew out a breath. "It does go on and on, doesn't it?"
"Want me to get on it, then?"
He shook his head. I expect whatever background information we need on Mr. Rochester isn't something we're going to dig up in Ludlow. I'll phone London in the morning.
21st May. Ironbridge, Shropshire. As usual, Yasmina rose before the rest of the family. Early light was filtering through the closed curtains, and she could hear the tree pipits' high-pitched calling, which always announced their yearly arrival. They liked the woodsy hillside that rose behind the Lomax home, and while their singing was pleasant, its ear-splitting conclusion generally served as a wake-up call, whether one wished to have such a thing or not. The birds didn't bother Timothy. They had done at one time, so he'd taken to wearing earplugs in order to sleep longer than the tree pipits wished him to do. But his need for something to block their noise had disappeared with his use of his sleeping aids. Now, if Yasmina didn't do something to awaken him, he could easily sleep till 1 or 2 in the afternoon. She found that Timothy's drug-induced slumber didn't bother her this morning. Her mood had shifted once she'd brought Justin Goodale on board with a strategy she'd devised to get Missa back on course. She went down the stairs in the silent house. She would have her morning tea at the table in the kitchen that looked out on the hillside. There a rock rose, thrived in one of the sunny spots, creating a haze of pink flowers against deeply green leaves. They didn't last long, that was their tragedy, but while they decorated the bush they were hard to look away from, and Yasmina found that in those quiet minutes of tea and flowers she could—
"Good morning, Mum."
Yasmina turned quickly towards the sitting room at Missa's greeting. She saw that her daughter was seated in an armchair with 2 suitcases on one side of it and 3 large cardboard boxes on the other. These latter bore a red-lettered advert for breakfast cereal, and the inane first thought that popped into Yasmina's head was the fact that Missa didn't eat cereal, but rather yogurt and fruit for breakfast. After that, the notion came to her that Missa had actually arrived at her own conclusion, one that told her she didn't belong in Ironbridge, but rather back in Ludlow. Following rapidly, in the way scenarios jump into the stream of ideas one has, was the startling possibility that Missa had spoken to Greta Yates on her own, and was returning to Ludlow to study independently at her grandmother's house, to catch up with everything she'd missed during the time she'd been gone, so that she could take her exams at the end of the current term. Yasmina tried to affect surprise, which wasn't difficult since she'd hardly expected such a quick result, but both surprise and triumph faded when she truly took in the expression on her daughter's face. Not exactly sullen, but rather unmoving, as if Missa had sat there for hours, dwelling on thoughts that had turned her features into concrete. Yasmina gestured to the suitcases and boxes.
"Goodness! What's this, my dear?" "I'm waiting for Justin," Missa said. "He and I spoke last night."
Yasmina became aware of cool air on her ankles, and she wondered if she'd left the kitchen window open last night. She thought she might have done. She had so much on her mind.
"I'm not certain," she began, but couldn't come up with what ought to follow. "We've spoken to his parents," Missa said. "Well, to his mum, actually. It was Justin who spoke to her. That was the important part. His daddy's easy about everything, but mum's... they can be rather difficult, can't they?"
Yasmina wondered what Justin's parents had to do with Missa's return to Ludlow, but she didn't ask. She had to say something in order to elicit more information, though, so she said,
"I don't quite understand. The boxes, the suitcases. Are you going somewhere?"
Missa didn't reply, and Yasmina felt herself being inspected in a way she'd never experienced from her daughter before. Something insidious seemed to be creeping across the sitting-room carpet towards her, seeping from Missa in a lava flow. Yasmina wanted suddenly to stop it, or at least try to redirect it, but she had no words that would not lead directly to those boxes and suitcases and Justin and his parents and what it all meant.
"You don't really know Justin," Missa said. "You think you do. I can see why. He seems so..." "You'd use the word simple, wouldn't you? Simple in his mind, simple in his actions, simple in his thoughts." "That's not true, Missa. Justin has always been the loveliest..." "Let's set all that aside,"
Missa's voice altered, becoming quite sharp.
"He told me, Mum. A to Z, start to finish, whatever you want to call it. The big plan, the course objective. You didn't think he would. But that's because you see him just like everyone else in your world. Clay. He's not. He's iron. But more than that, he's real. He's shown you that from the first. But instead of real, you saw simple, like I said.
You reckoned you could use him and miss her. I did not, and I'd never work it out. What you didn't reckon was that for him the truth is more important than what he might want, or, in this case, what he might be offered.
Yasmina wanted to stop her. There was, she noted, an odd new scent in the air. Medicinal, it seemed. She didn't like it. She would have to speak to their cleaner. Her house smelled vaguely like a swimming pool. They couldn't have that. She said, "I'm not sure what you're talking about, Missa."
"Oh, my God," Missa said. "Oh, my God, Mum. Just now, just here in this sitting room, I'm telling you that last night Justin explained the big plan. Oh, he started out exactly how you intended, telling me that you were badgering him to speak to me about West Mercia College, that the only way he could manage to get you to leave him be, he reckoned, was for me to go to the college to meet with a counsellor, that he would take me there and all the rest. Only he couldn't, you see? Not like you thought he would, because what he knew was that the second I got into the car with him to go to Ludlow, I'd see it on his face anyway. So he told me the truth. Missa, surely you see the importance of—"
Missa surged to her feet.
"I do not!"
Her voice was loud. She would awaken Sati. Things would fall apart from there. Yasmina said,
"Please, we can talk about this when—" "We're not talking. We are finished talking. Because talking to you is all about me listening to you, and then trying to talk to you, and then crumbling, and never once saying, telling you. And I'm done with that. I'm done, done, done. Stop shrieking. You're going to wake your sister, or your father, and that will be bad, won't it, Mum? They might actually see what you've been up to. They might see who you are, and what you want, and how the only thing that has ever, for a moment, mattered to you is what things look like, not how they are. And if they see that, you're finished, aren't you? Finished the way this family is finished, and you can't see it, and you won't admit it, and I'm not part of it any longer, all right? Do you hear me? Do you?"
She grabbed up a framed picture that stood on the table next to her armchair, and she smashed it on the floor.
"I'm not part of this fucking charade! I'm not! I won't be! I—" "Stop it at once! Stop that language and stop this hysteria! I won't!" she cried. "I goddamn bloody fucking won't!"
And that was on a scream. And that did it. Sati came dashing down the stairs. She saw Yasmina and Missa facing off, and she saw the suitcases and the boxes. She began to wail.
"Missa, no, 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 I want to go. I want to go with you, please."
She ran towards Missa, but Yasmina caught her arm.
"Sati, go to your room," she hissed. "Go, at once. Go."
She shoved the girl towards the stairway.
"Stop that,"
Missa shrieked.
"Leave her alone. Missa,"
Sati cried.
"Don't worry," Missa called to her. "I'll come for you. It won't be long, Sati, don't worry."
Yasmina whirled towards her.
"Sati's going nowhere, and neither are you. Go to your room at once. Take those suitcases with you. We'll deal with the rest when your father—" "You don't know anything. You don't know me, and you never bloody will, because...
She began to weep, like Sati, but wilder and with an anguish that made Yasmina grow cold to the roots of her hair. She said,
"Missa, my God!"
But her daughter shoved past her. That was when the doorbell rang. It was, of course, Justin. Missa did, of course, throw herself into the young man's arms. He spoke, of course, as he always spoke, saying,
"Steady on, miss. It's good. With my mum and my dad. Like I said it would be."
Yasmina said,
"She's meant to stay here."
Which was all Missa needed. She dashed out of the house and into the street, where, doubtless, Justin's car stood waiting. Justin remained where he was, clearly torn between going after Missa to offer comfort and fetching her belongings, which he was obviously meant to do. It was, after all, part of the plan he and Missa had concocted during their conversation on the previous night. He said,
"Dr. Lomax, I couldn't. I had to tell her, and then she said she didn't care about any of it. The wedding, the house, the honeymoon, or whatever."
And here he blushed in that Justin way and said,
"I don't mean we won't marry. We will, of course. It's what we both want. And we'll wait till we do. For the rest, I mean. No worries there. Mum says Missa can use my sister's bedroom. They're long gone, see, and, well—"
He was good enough not to mention the tears that were coursing down Yasmina's cheeks. He saw them, naturally. He even patted her on the shoulder as he went for Missa's two suitcases. He would return in a moment for the boxes. It was all so easily accomplished when one made a plan. And then they were gone. But there was Sati to be dealt with, and her hysterical weeping, which Yasmina could hear even from behind the girl's closed bedroom door. Only, as she got to the top of the stairs, she saw that Sati had not gone to her room at all, but rather to rouse her father, to get him to intervene.
"Mummy, He won't wake up!
The girl sobbed as she pulled on Timothy's arm and cried,
Daddy! Daddy!
Yasmina ran to the bed. She pulled Sati away. She said, Wait in your room.
But he won't. What's wrong with him? Mummy, what's wrong?
Yasmina bent over him. His colour was very bad. His respiration was stertorous, but it was there. She said his name loudly. No response. Then she shouted it, while behind her she heard Sati sink to the floor, crying,
No! No!
Yasmina pulled the covers off her husband. She climbed onto the bed and straddled his body. She made a fist. Fiercely she began to rub the centre of his chest. She used the weight of her body to put as much pressure into the rubbing as she could. Behind her, Sati cried,
Mammy, what's wrong with him? I'll ring 999. Should I ring 999? No!